Great. Thank you for this loyalty to the program, being here on the very last morning. I have had a wonderful time. I hope all of you have. It's been just so great working with the co-organizers, and I wish Roya were here so I could say thank you also to her. And I'm glad that Marty's here, because Marty does everything, and he does it quietly, and he's just amazing, and this was no exception. And I guess if I have one regret, Marty's been so busy, I haven't dropped in and seen him as much as I had previous visits. But such a terrific operation, and everybody who's been through the whole program, it's been just such wonderful learning the whole time. And one measure of how much I think I learned was how little I expected to be talking about the things I ended up talking about. You know, you come with some idea what you're going to think about. And, it makes it a little difficult to decide now what to do as a final closing out. And I wanted to just cover a couple of things that came up during the program that I think give us an idea what way to be looking after this. There's a funny thing going on here where everybody's bringing to this subject what they learned before they came to it. It's a very interesting bit of psychology that I was noticing in talking to people. And I think the most powerful and clearly good one is just the preoccupation with the vacuum, this miracle of something out of nothing that Casimir made available to us. And, you know, we realize we're living in this vacuum infinity and all this kind of good stuff, and that it actually has physical consequences. It's so seductive that I think that we just think about vacuum a lot. However, I think the other thing is, if we would know two kinds of things about this subject, one, the very different motivations people bring to it, and a bit of the history, because I think the thing that struck me as a kid, and I define kid as anybody sort of 10 years younger than I am, or less, is we're going to have to stick together. is that you don't realize just all the trends that came in this. I see, unfortunately, I'm going to mention it a few times, it's really unfortunate, there's a lot of controversy here, people not being very nice to each other. And for some reason, it happens in this subject all the way through. I don't know how many of you know the history from the point of view of Casimir himself, but he was the son-in-law of the great Fervet, of Fervet and Overbeck. And I don't know how many of you have read the book on the stability of lyophobic colloids by Fervet and Overbeck, but this was a book that was written in secret during World War II, during Nazi occupation of the company in Eindhoven in Holland. And it had a kind of a isolated character in its early days that defined it away from what some other things were going on. Similarly, in Russia, Deryagin and Landau were writing their first great paper in this subject. I think it was 1941. And that, again, was a thing that was just done on the side. And these guys didn't even know each other. They had good reason not to cite each other. They didn't even know the work had been done. So there was this Dutch tradition of colloid science, the European tradition of colloid science, which actually motivating this work. And there was this wonderful school of physics in Russia which was being joined to colloid science on that side. So you could even see how the two traditions stayed apart for a long time. I don't know how many of you like drama in science, but one of the most shocking things I ever read as a kid was the discussions of the Faraday Society in the 1960s, the arguments between Deryagin and Overbeck and these guys, just to see how people were coming at these things from such different points of view. Read it. You'll really see some of us at our worst, but you'll also see the kinds of things that go on, and might have echoes here. One of the really remarkable things in that discussion of the Faraday Society was a discussion of charge contaminating force measurements. And Deryagin was very clear on where these things are. And you know, for the last 12 years, we're facing that same problem here now. So it's really good to see that these guys were really, really facing these things then and see it in that context. So I I kind of like to think of a Venn diagram when I'm talking about this subject. People remember Venn diagrams? Circles? Yes. So there's sort of a world of vacuum. And we call this Casimir, of course. And then there's a world of charge fluctuations. And we'll use various words like van der Waals or much more modern way, Lifshitz. And then there's this huge world, huge, of all the stuff behind it in colloid science. Virtually all of colloid science is based on the obviousness of having van der Waals forces driving processes. And I think that the nice intersection is when Fervet can get his son-in-law to show that the vacuum does stuff in colloids. That's a nice part of it. The not so nice part of it is these guys who are working with colloids have very great difficulty accessing the good physics that's in these areas. And you'll find enormous simplifications. So I said this was a Venn diagram, and I guess what I wish would be happening more, and it's happening a bit, is this kind of thing here. It happened a little bit during this meeting. I was delighted when Roger French came and gave us this marvelous talks on spectra, the reality of designing materials. And it was just a huge pleasure for me to see him making friends with some of the real physicist vacuum guys too. So, and that's another nice story. I was writing this book, and in all immodesty, I clicked on Google, my name next to van der Waals, and I found that for decades, people in the DuPont labs had been collecting spectra to make devices based on charge fluctuation forces. There was a vast, vast body of literature. And I'll say this almost as an advertisement. Roger told me when he was here, this workshop, that he has dozens of liquids on which he has complete dielectric spectra that DuPont asked him to work on for some product. They never made the product, but that's all available. And that we, if getting together and thinking about things to do, there's a huge amount of good stuff that's available to be done. And I'm not saying that as an advertisement. I'm saying it when there's an intersection of fields, you can really cash in on stuff. So, now, I wanted to do the following thing. I'm not just going to show a slide of what I think we should be thinking about next. I want to give some features of the electrodynamic interactions that I think have been pretty much neglected here. I'm surprised at that. And then I want to go back and talk about some of the measurements that people still believe that they rarely quote. And I think I don't mean that in a harsh way, but there really were some magnificent measurements that do stand up to scrutiny. So first of all, what you call it depends on where you came from. And I think that these words get used, and my favorite operational definition of what's the right term is from Mehran. He said, whatever name gets us to be able to sit down and talk together and bring us to a good place, that's the good name for it. Do I misquote? So we got ourselves here on that one. No arguing. But I think you'll see the traditions here immediately. Van der Waals, of course, from his guest. And by the way, how many of you know, I'm going to come to this at the end, this is a very interesting thing. How many of you know what van der Waals was most pleased about in the van der Waals equation? Not the correction to the gas equation that you get, you know, P plus something over V squared, but that he recognized that was the driving force to condense the gas. And his thesis, I'm going to mention it at the end, was on the continuity of the gas and liquid states. So that while we talk about van der Waals' gas, he actually was already thinking about condensed media. Really a really good point to think about. We sort of think of him as sort of a lightweight, airy guy. But in fact, he really does have the idea of creating serious structures from these forces already in his earliest work. So I will now get past the vocabulary and more thank yous. And this is, I was trying to make a list of stuff that I wish we would carry away, and I put this at the beginning, not at the end, because I think it's a good time to get it, and a lot of people have to leave the room early. So just, I think one of the very good things is not sophomore geometries and real materials. I think there's very good progress in that. That's the really sweetest thing for me here, to see all the good stuff that's going on for giving ourselves a little bit better armamentarium of physics. I'm going to emphasize this one. There's a kind of a funny thing going on where we've been brought up to think about fluctuations in dynamics. And in fact, for many materials, virtually all the stuff we're made out of, the very low frequency dipolar interactions or polar interactions are actually dominant. And these are things that happen at such low frequencies that they're temperature dependent, and they're quite different from what we usually think about metals and high frequencies. So these low frequency terms dominate at long distances because they basically have infinite wavelength, especially at room temperature where you get a decent amount of kick from the air, and it's important with polar materials. This next one is dicey. It's really a huge realization, and I think it's a heartbreak for many people, controlling the conditions of the measurements. People have completely underestimated how careful they have to be doing measurements. And I'll tell a couple of stories about that. But if we are really measuring what we think we're measuring, you're going to have high vacuum for clean surfaces. How high? So I'm working with Mal Schrader, a scientist at the Office of Naval Research, and he's facing a huge controversy. An obvious question: is gold wettable? If I put a drop of water on gold, will it spread? Gold is a conductor, highly polar. Water is reasonably polar. The vacuum is not. The best, it's not polar. Yeah, take notes. The best measurements of probably the best surface physicist in the world at the time was a man named Zisman, William Zisman, at the Naval Research Labs. And he had taken clean gold surfaces and he put water on it, and he found that the water spread on the gold. But then a huge number of people followed him, starting to put drops of water on metal, gold, and they were finding it rounded up. What was going on? It was apparently a huge controversy at the time. And Mal, my friend, decided he's going to re-examine all this. And he did the obvious thing. First of all, he made the gold, sputtered it in a very, very high vacuum. How high? 10 to the minus 11 torr. Really heavy stuff. Then by using a cold finger, he transferred water to the gold, and indeed, the water spread on the surface, just as the theory had said it should. It contradicted virtually all the measurements in the field. He took that gold surface out and put it in the air. He said after about a minute, maybe less, if he brought water to that surface, the gold would not be wet by water. Within seconds, tens of seconds, that high energy surface had become contaminated, and you simply did not have a reasonable way to think about it anymore. The reason he came to me, we were just working on these van der Waals forces at the time, and it's been solving many equations with layered structures. He said, how thick a layer do I need to make that drop think it's on hydrocarbon, not on gold? And the answer is about a monolayer will do it. So immediately, any of these measurements with high energies, unless you are really, really pumping hard and cleaning really clean, this excuse of doing conductors, because that's what the theory gives and gives big results, doesn't work, because you're not looking at gold anymore. And that's a biggie. So I think that's been the problem in so many of the things here. And it was really one of these nice ideas of talking to somebody who's really engineering-oriented to see that he really wanted to get it right. Yeah?
Are you going to elaborate on what you mean by piece apart?
Elaborate piece apart.
The second one. What exactly do you mean by piece apart?
Yes. Now, there's a contradiction in your question, because I hope you won't leave by the time I get to it.
Oh.
Right. So tell me to talk fast. If you're getting antsy, tell me. Come on. So the other thing is, of course, what we really have to have is data on the samples themselves. If you think you have a certain interaction and you have a certain hunk of stuff you're working with, you better know what the forces are that you expect. This is probably obvious, but it's not satisfied roughly 98% of the time. So this is a biggie. What's happening very nicely now, learning how the forces change with shapes and with materials. And that you've seen some good examples of it, and I suspect there'll be lots and lots of things going on. The last one's a throwaway one, but I had it this much before, so for that, because I don't know why you guys are arguing. These experimental guys are arguing with each other so much, but it's been a bit of a culture shock for me. I tend to play Mr. Magoo when people are arguing. It's much better to sort of let it happen. But I think it's been a little bit destructive. I think it's probably a good idea not to. So if there are not objections to this or want to discuss, I'm going to tell you a couple of stories. If this button works, I'll tell you a couple of stories. Okay, so I'm going to go back to an approximate form of what Lipschitz derived in 54 or something like that. And the reason I want to do this is because I want to make very clear how we're looking at materials and how the results show up. First of all, the rough form of an interaction between two half spaces is inverse square, but it has a coefficient, as you all know, that can itself depend on frequency, or can depend on distance. If we look at this guy a little bit more carefully, there's lots of neat physics in it, and I won't rhapsodize too much on that, but we do know that the interesting properties of the material are at these Matsubara frequencies, multiples of thermal energy, and I'll give you a little map of that in a minute. And it turns out that when you sample at those frequencies, starting from so-called zero frequency, that there is a screening of the contribution. The faster the fluctuation, the more the exertion of this, and it's showing up in a very nice ratio. It's very intuitive. This is a relativistic screening factor. You can see it's less than or equal to 1. It's approximate, but it's really pretty good. And the germ of it is this ratio. And that ratio is how long does it take for a signal to go across and back compared to the period of a fluctuation. Totally intuitive. So if I'm fluctuating and I want to correlate across, if I'm sending a signal, it's got to go and come back, I may fall out of step if I wait too long. And the idea is we could look at this in terms of thermal wavelength. We can look at it in terms of eigenfrequencies. We can look at it in terms of velocity of light. The main thing is to see that we're looking in a kind of a natural unit. And this is really important. We're looking at a natural unit of microns for this wavelength at which good stuff happens. The other thing is obvious, but you might as well say it. You wouldn't have a force if you didn't have a difference in the materials. And that is showing up here. And again, more rhapsodizing on what this looks like, resonance and all that, you don't need that right now. What you do need, and I hate to say this, I don't sound like a parent, but if you begin to look at the distances over which we've been hearing these measurements, you having a vocabulary argument?
I was just confused about H bar and the addition of 2 pi, but
that's we discussed that last night at approximately 7:30. It's called radians or something. So watch it. This is really neat. Guys, you got to pay attention. Andreas, let us know. Speak.
I'm worried about the 2 pi.
It's just units. It's radians and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a factor of 6. I mean,
well, 6.28, not to put too fine a point on it, yeah.
It's not a magnitude.
Yeah, it's certainly a fun thing. And I don't want to start telling 2 pi stories. We have too many of them. We'll never finish. It's okay. Anyway, if you don't have it there, then you take it out someplace else, too. It's all ratios. Don't worry. But here's the important part. The distances over which we've been hearing about measurements, the distances, if we turn around and we say, I'm going to consider these distances, a factor of 100, And we ask ourselves, this ratio of travel time across and back compared to period of a fluctuation, how far along do I get in this sum before that ratio equals 1? Not bad. See, so what's it telling you? At 100 nanometers, 0.1 microns, roughly you go only about 6 or 7 of these terms, and already you're feeling this crowding out. And remember, these are discrete frequencies. I'm going to show it to you in a second, so that you're really cutting out frequencies of different behavior. If you go to a micron, and we've seen microns here, even the very first term, the screening factor, and I wrote out this guy here, for the very first term is killed by over 50%. And when you get to 10 microns, we've even seen some data like that, basically all you're left with is what I'm going to talk about a good bit later, the very, very first term in the summation. Nowhere are you looking at this the way virtually everyone has been doing, with a few good exceptions, as though you're at zero temperature and you're able to smooth this out into an integral. There was a nice comment by one of the younger people here who said he was surprised. He said, I thought everything was solved in the theory, and here you tell me you don't even know the first term. And I'm going to tell you about the first term. But the point is, you do have to know the first term. Is it clear what I'm saying? So nothing up either sleeve. This is just arithmetic. So let's just get a hint about this. Again, this, thanks, Thorsten, allowed me to translate into some other units here that made more sense. But the very first eigenfrequency, non-zero eigenfrequency, is already in the infrared. That means if I'm sampling material, I do the zero frequency, I leap over the entire microwave spectrum and I look at the next one. And why is that? Because temperature excites the modes so that the details are not so important in that region. That's the way I like to read it. And if you go and you look at the first 10 terms, you see only then do you even get to the borderline of the visible spectrum, and it's only 10 terms. This is something typically people, I don't know why, they treat it as an integral. I don't know why. So the first sampling frequency corresponds to infrared, and that the lambda 1 that we've been talking about is about 8,000 angstroms. It's in the red. It's in the red, but it's not... Not near zero. And these are other languages. People like to think in different ways for what the frequency or the wavelength would be. Keep this in mind during the next several minutes. Keep this in mind. If I look at the effect of a single oscillator, now just take a wavelength of 500 angstroms, a really decent UV wavelength, okay? And I say to myself, I'm just going to make believe I've only that oscillator going on this problem, two bodies across a vacuum. And I ask myself, what happens to the screening, the effective power of the interaction? I know when I'm very, very close, my interaction should go as inverse square between two half spaces. As I screen out this interaction, it has to appear that I'm cutting out modes more than relaxing the material, and that's the Casimir regime, where wavelength dominates the behavior. But it doesn't take long before this discreteness comes in. And this discreteness, this is going to be at 10,000 angstroms already, separation. You see, suddenly, you're deviating from this at a micron, and you're coming back to that so-called zero-frequency term. We're all brought up on the idea that this red line goes up here and stays here until you get to the, I don't know, where you watch the seals or something. But this is a very different behavior, and I'll tell you right now, this is the one that you see most of the time in biological materials. But it's also true for any of these things, and it's in Landau-Lipschitz's book. It's not even a big thing. So now let's ask, take the classical case. Two metals at room temperature, and do all the idealizations that physicists love to do. Let the epsilons go to infinity, so these guys go to 1. And just look at the summation. And what you see is that if you did it this way, you'd get you'd get this form for the interaction, for the coefficient. If you remember then, you should have had the magnetic terms, and you remember you didn't sum it right. Actually, it's a little bit more complicated, but the same idea, you're getting an inverse square. The zeta function is about 1.13 or something, I forget. Not a big deal. But if you looked at is this a Casimir, this is what you'd be thinking you should be looking at. So there's a cultural thing going on here that everybody feels honor bound to be thinking this. And in fact, if you do the thing with temperature and distance, it's really this.
This is known.
This is known. It's been known for 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. Why it's not in every lecture and understood, I don't know. I don't mean to insult people, but it's pretty amazing. This is old-time religion, if you went back to the literature of the 50s and 60s. I'm going to talk about why it's handy now in a minute. If he doesn't leave the room, he'll even hear it.
Oh,
no, I'm talking fast. It's good.
Yeah, okay. But there are no measurements of 10 microns.
No, it's theoretically known, the temperature correction, there is no controversy in that. There are no measurements. So
even the use of the phrase temperature correction, I will take issue. I'll show you data that it's the temperature.
Eventually, it's a black body alone. Yes. So there are no measurements of that regime.
Maybe 3 microns, but not
with enough sensitivity.
If you are anywhere above a micron, your discrete sampling is changing the form. That's if you're taking any kind of a derivative in there, your discreteness makes a big difference. We started to do some exercises on that, so that it's important at least to treat it as a summation, because each one of those terms is decaying different rates. These are all supposed to be twiddles. I don't know what happened. I guess every PowerPoint has to have a dumb thing happening. Okay, so what do we do? So at 8 o'clock last night, we were busy trying to figure out a good example. So there's this wonderful calculation of two metal wires where you have really long kind of wavelength, if you can call it that, fluctuations. And it's coming out in that, as it should be for two wires with monopolar fluctuations, logarithmic. Oh, sorry, excuse me, metallic wire with a plane. Absolutely, yes. That's why we decided it's first power. Huh? Thank you. if you go and you look at it as though you're just adding up along the thing, you see you get a very, very different behavior. So the whole quality of the interaction changes when you have long collective fluctuations.
I have mentioned it several times during you see it already in two dimensions, the logarithm coming up.
Yeah.
There are no long range fluctuations. I mean, basically, it's just. So it's probably a property of a co dimension rather than this naive long.
Well, I think it's basically the same thing.
But there's nothing fluctuating in two dimensions in this direction.
But because you have these long-range fluctuations in 3D, you can map it to 2D.
Well,
it's kind of the long-range, the charge distribution does not change along the axis, and therefore you can map it to 2D. I think that's it.
I would say it is just the opposite way around. You take your 2D result and integrate it naively in the Z direction. And the 2D result is not destroyed by doing this.
I think you could sort of find a harmony by approaching from different limits. Anyway, one of my favorite people here is Andres, because he and I are jelly bean people. And I wanted to make sure that in that case. also, I have a tradition in my lectures of giving chocolate. Well, I didn't have chocolate this time. People didn't eat chocolate here. Physical theorists don't eat chocolate, apparently. At least not cheap chocolate. So I have $10 off cards at Jade. So my tradition is also, for a good question, you get the prize. But we also have room for bad questions. But it has to be such a bad question that it's memorably bad. But we don't say which it is when we give the card. So ask questions, yeah. Okay. Anyway, I wanted to go through some very old stuff and then bring it very fast up to some very new stuff, because I just want to remind us what's behind all this. The thing that started me off, I've told some of you already, when I was a kid, I read this article in Scientific American where Derriagen showed the first measurements in English, I guess. And it was a great experience for me. And then later on, of course, I read their other papers. There are force balance measurements, and what was really magnificent about these was that they were able to take the index of refraction, the optical properties of the quartz, the glass, and get, in vacuum at least, get a clear prediction of what the interaction should be. And that Faraday discussion that I described was where this paper was debated, and there were huge discussions about whether surfaces are contaminated or not. And the Russians solved it. There are measurements we know between mica surfaces. The problem with mica is that the surface is nice and smooth, but mica optical properties vary every place. So unless you really have good data, I remember during the Gordon conference, if it's sunny, I always go climb a mountain in the afternoon, but if it's raining, there's a mica mine, which is a very interesting place to visit if you're in a New Hampshire Gordon conference. So I spent the afternoon, and it may even have been with Jacob, I forget, collecting mica samples. And what amazed me was in one mine, in the course of a 1 hour, 2 hour walk, we got micas that looked a lot of different colors. There's all kinds of different ions in these things. So it's interesting what is and is not reliable in the different materials. A measurement that I thought was just page turning, just the history turning, virtually ignored. I don't know anybody. Has anybody ever seen this measurement where you take a bilayer membrane, these would be two soap molecules, layers of soap molecules, with a hydrocarbon drop, and from Newton's rings calculate the angle? Has anyone ever seen this? It's an absolutely amazing measurement. It was hidden in a very obscure journal, so people may not have noticed it. But basically, from the contact angle and the known surface tension, it's possible to infer the attractive force of water across a hydrocarbon. And Barry Ninnem and I, it was our first calculation we did together in our great lifetime adventure, friendship and work. We figured out a way to get this measured energy from the spectra as we knew it for bilayers. It's amazing to me, such a nice measurement, and it's virtually unknown. I don't know how quotations were. For me, it was absolutely pivotal.
How accurate can you measure those angles?
Apparently with the Newton's rings, you can do very well. Yeah, there's a lot of work on these thin films, soap films. Soap people do a lot of stuff on measuring angles, and apparently they do a good job with it. Yeah. It's not a big angle, but you do see the rings. And in a sense, that's good, because the rings are at least far apart. Yeah, so it's not a bad way to look at it. Much later, my buddies Evan Evans and Peter Rand worked out a technique where you could take two vesicles, catch them on a pair of pipettes, and suck, and hold them near each other, and you let the pressure off, and suddenly they flatten against each other. And then you can pull, and you can see how much material you've pulled from the flattened region by the extension in the capillary, but you also know how hard you're pulling with your sucking force. And you can actually infer the attraction, this time between two bilayers. Then Peter and I did some measurements on multilayers. I didn't draw a picture of it here. And what we did was, I'll tell you a lot about multilayers in a minute, but right now all you need to know is that they're bilayers, but in a stack. And you can measure the spacings between them with X-ray diffraction, and you can measure the forces between them by pushing them together or swelling them. But for right now, basically what we found was we could take the measurements on the mica apparatus, the measurements from the multilayers, the measurements from pulling in this pipette apparatus, and you can put everything together and get a very nice consistent estimate of the forces between layers in water. again, people tell me they want to do Casimir in vacuum. I think sometimes having a medium helps because contamination doesn't show up so heavily. I remember a thing I was worried about, a contaminant once. Peter and I were doing some measurements with these multi-layers. I guess I'll show a picture of it in a minute. I'll go back to it in a second. I'll tell the story later. I don't want to mess this up. So a measurement that has worked rather nicely, I was lucky to meet Arnold Shee. He was working in the lab of Polycarp Kush in the early 1970s. And they had developed an atomic beam technique where they were shooting cesium, potassium, rubidium atoms across a cylinder of gold. And basically from the deflection profile, you can work out the impact parameter and the strength of interaction. So what we were able to do was to, I rederived a more complete statement with retardation and everything of particle surface interactions using the Lifshitz idea. And what we were able to do is go back and see if we could predict the coefficient. But we were suffering from the fact that the gold on the cylinder was not the gold for which we had spectra. So we used several different people's spectra, and we got what we thought at the time was very nice, about a 50% agreement, roughly, between the actual measurement and the estimate with an assumed gold spectrum. It was, at that time, very satisfying to do. And I think for the purposes of us here, it showed very, very cleanly an inverse cube interaction over a range, I think, from 200 to 700 angstroms impact per hour. It's really a very nice thing to be able to get to that degree of detail. It's a big enough distance so you don't worry about roughness on the surface. It's a small enough distance so you get a very clean power law. So it does teach you a lot. Now, the next one is my totally all-time favorite measurement. I had nothing to do with it, so I don't have to sound biased. But these two guys work in the RCA labs. Believe it or not, RCA actually had a great lab at one time. This was toward the end of it. They looked at the climbing of helium on a ceramic vessel. And they can trace that out very, very well. I put air here in sort of a, it's obviously not really air. I mean, this is epsilon equals one stuff. But from this contour, from knowing the dielectric properties of the walls, which they really got exactly, I mean, that you can get for these ceramics, you can do that very well. They got a magnificent, they measured the full spectrum, and they used the full spectrum of the helium. And this is one of the very few real, i.e. satisfactory, comparisons of measurement with theory. You can see the power law, you can see the coefficient, it's all here. The Russians did some similar measurements, they didn't have quite as good materials. But this is just a magnificent landmark study, which this guy retired soon after, and this guy went into biology. So anyway, but these are really things to look at. Just Dennis Prevey did a very nice set of measurements looking at a colloid bouncing on a surface. And that also is consistent with the right power of the interaction. Now, I want to tell a story a little bit about multilayers. This is a recent story with these people here. If we start with neutral bilayers, and what is this? The green stuff is a water-soluble group. The wiggly guys are hydrocarbon chains, and what's in between is water. These are so-called lipid bilayers, but as I said, they form a membrane stack. It's possible with the X-ray scattering to measure the distances between them and the repeat spacing. So you can get lots and lots and lots of information. In fact, we've been using the system for actually measuring forces in a large variety of systems. But you can get a very nice spectrum that'll tell you what the separation is between the layers. And what I'm going to tell you now is what happens if you put stuff in the water. Again, one of the things I absolutely loved, the Lifshitz theory, when I first became aware of it as a kid, was that it really allowed you to look at solutions. You really look at stuff as it comes to you instead of idealizing it. And this is an amazing measurement. I should just emphasize it now because I'm going to tell you something. in the example I'm going to give you, the green stuff is electrically neutral. Okay? This is oily, gooky stuff, and this is just plain water, as clean as you can make it. Then you add a little bit of salt, but you try to do as harmless as salt as possible. What's harmless? Sodium chloride, potassium chloride, bromide. And what you see is that the repeat spacing increases immediately. But it depends whether you use a bromide or a chloride for the salt. What was behind our thinking in doing this? Well, one, we had been measuring these forces, and I'm not going to put you through the force measurements, but basically this is a distance at which these layers are in equilibrium with excess salt solution. So there's a balance of attraction and repulsion at these points. There are cases where you can put things in there that make them repel, and you lose your X-ray spacing. There are ways of putting polymers in the water and pushing these guys together and measuring forces. But I'm giving you a very simple statement here. Just take salt water and see what happens to the forces stabilizing. And clearly, there's a weakening of what's holding them together. Actually, there's another thing you might enjoy thinking about. It's going the wrong way for temperature swelling up. Yeah?
But to find out what the distance is, you said they did X-ray diffraction?
Right.
But doesn't it have to be crystalline to do X-ray diffraction?
It's liquid crystalline, and you measure there are a couple of ways of measuring the thickness of the bilayer, because you get enough reflections, so you can actually reconstruct the electron density map. There's another way to do it, actually. It's a little easier, which is to deprive it of water, of excess water, and just keep taking away water until you see just that point where you're beginning to stress it, so you know exactly how much water is in between the bilayers from your stoichiometric mixture that you made. So there's sort of two ways of knowing that separation. From the way you're looking, either you're being polite, or I'm puzzling you, or...
Okay.
I'm from New York, you don't have to be polite. Okay. Good. So what's happening is, and this is Horia Petraki's work in our lab at that time, that whatever the attractions are that are stabilizing this thing are going away with the added salt. And it turned out, as far as we could see, there are at least three things going on. One, I came out small, salt screening and weakening of the van der Waals force. Maybe this is worth just a comment. I should have made a slide on it. You remember the bifuckle theory, that if you have two charges, right, there's not only a 1 over r interaction, but there's a e to the minus kappa r screening. Remember that one? What's going on here, and there's a lot of theory behind this, is the following. If I have two half spaces, and I'll just do it for half spaces, although, of course, you can do it for finite layers, too. If there is a fluctuation that's going across here, that it was originally causing an inverse square energy of interaction, what's really going on is if these are ionically screened, if these fluctuations are so slow that the ions can follow them, basically any signal going across there and coming back is going to get screened. And what is that screening? It's an e to the minus kappa L, and then another one for the correspondence between the two. So what you have is a salt screening of the electrostatic forces, of the van der Waals forces. And in fact, it's so strong that it takes away about half the van der Waals force. Why is the van der Waals force so strong here? It's this guy here, the epsilon of the stuff minus the epsilon of the water over epsilon stuff plus epsilon of the water squared. If this is mainly a hydrocarbon, and this is 80 for low dike, this is practically 1. It's huge. Remember, if these were indices of refraction, you'd be talking about the Mickey Mouse show, right? There'd be like a 10% difference here, and it ends up being like 10 to the minus 1 or something like that. So even though there's only one term at this frequency, zero frequency. And basically, you don't want to think about a frequency. It's just basically a partition function for all the ways things could be moving. You're getting a very strong interaction that is screened out by the salt. But it's screened out doubly fast. But as I said, there are at least three things going on here. This effect, Barry and I actually derived some equations many years ago when we were worrying about salt. But it came in handy here because there are two other things going on. One, what I told you. Two, now I'll save that one's good. Let me go over to this one. If I go to very high frequencies, then my epsilons are more like indices of refraction squared. So you know when your mother hit you and said, don't do that when you were a kid because you were putting salt in the water at the table, right? Remember that? You were learning about Schlieren and all these good stuff and she was stopping you, but that's okay. You ended well. But you're changing the index of refraction of the water. And basically that's what's going on at the high frequencies. Lipids have typically an index of refraction of 1.4, 1.45. Water typically has an index of refraction of about 1.33, something or other. So as you increase the index of refraction of the water, you're actually making the difference less. So there's another effect going in at the higher salts. And Peter and I worked on that quite some time with neutral solutes and charged solutes, all kinds of things. Then there's a third thing I like very much that Barry Ninham's been pushing a lot, and I think pushing for a good reason. If I have an ion that's big and juicy and polarizable, bromide compared to chloride, and I have a hydrocarbon, which does have a higher index of refraction at the optical frequencies, there's actually, in addition to all the electrostatics we think about ions, you know, nonpolar materials, there's actually an attractive force between the ion, the polarizable ion, and the hydrocarbon. And that goes a good ways to explaining why many hydrocarbons become charged when you put them in salt water. You could do electrophoresis on a neutral salt water oil drop material. But what seems to be going on is the more polarizable bromide is conferring an extra electrostatic repulsion by virtue of its being attracted by a charge fluctuation force to the surface. And we worked that out as an effective binding constant. And I see a grimace on Meron's face, so he's going to get a card.
Attraction, repulsion, I
sorry?
So you said the bromine was attracted,
yeah.
And then the two surfaces repelled.
Because you're basically charging the surfaces. Yeah, it's charging the surface. I think, given the paucity of questions, but eat that first, will you please?
There was another question, right?
Oh, that was a good question. Yeah, you're here. Boy, this is perfect. These guys are here. No. You guys are here for a couple of days. Nice. It doesn't work on the other guys. We're all leaving. So. Okay, so this funny story. Okay. So this is not on fluctuation forces, okay? I will tell you that. So I'm writing this book, and I'm working very hard on charge fluctuation forces. And Kevin Cahill, who is a very good physicist at the University of New Mexico, was on sabbatical, a couple of rooms down, and he said, Adrian, you know, you're always talking about second order charge fluctuation forces, right? Why second order? Well, what do we know?
Zero order is a guy all by himself. First order is just not screwing up the electrons, but you can put
that would mess up the electrons, wouldn't it? But just seeing what the Coulomb interactions are. And then, of course, second order is what we've been talking about for the last 3 months, all the fluctuations that occur and how they're perturbed as you come closer and closer together. So he said, what about first order interactions? And I gave him the usual religious response that they're exponentially dying because wave functions die exponentially. And he said, okay, wasn't so sure about it. So he went and he came back and said, Adrian, I'm getting an interaction that's comparable to what you're telling me goes on between two noble gas ions, atoms. So my only response was, Kevin, I don't believe you. do a double precision. So he comes back in another week, and he comes double precision, and he gets the same answer. So then we say, well, let's go talk to Rudy Podgornik, who's sitting in his office. So Rudy is being younger than we are, immediately dials up Mathematica, and he checks one of Kevin's integrals, and he's right. He's got the right answer. So at this point, I was desperate. What do you do when you're desperate? What do you do when you're desperate as a physicist? You don't understand something. You find Landau Lipschitz, right? So I said, these guys thought of everything, so let's go look. So I start looking, and I came across this footnote that he says, they're talking about van der Waals forces and charge fluctuations, and they say, this, of course, does not imply that the mean value of the interaction energy of the atoms is precisely zero. It diminishes exponentially with distance. Well, you know that wave functions die exponentially. More rapidly than every finite power of 1 over r. Remember, we're looking, van der Waals force is defined in the limit of what happens when you're coming in from infinity. And hence, each term of the expansion vanishes. This occurs because the expansion of the interaction operator in terms of the multipole moments involves the assumption that the charges of two atoms are at a large distance r apart. Whereas in quantum mechanics, the electron density distribution has finite, though exponentially small values, even at large distances. Kapow. Anybody heard of condensed media? So, what do we do? Kevin then went and he took the molecular orbitals of Aziz and company and did a very, very careful computation of the force between, he did krypton-krypton, hydrogen-hydrogen, sodium-sodium, and potassium-potassium, I think. I forget which one. This is krypton-krypton. So what did he do? He found that you could put this term, this Rydberg term, the thing you use in vibration theory, and if you did a kind of dirty trick, you said at close distances it looks like that, except for this term here. And at far distances it goes over to d over r to the sixth, which it should if you have long enough distance, then you can actually get your line to go through all those points. Now, these little pluses are the calculation, and the line here is using this formula. Okay, it really fits. If you went and did what every statistical mechanician does and made believe you had a 612 potential, it diverges enormously. Worse than that, the coefficient of the six that you have to use to fit the minimum is two or three times the six that you know must exist from the polarizability of the atoms. It's just a kludge. And those of you, so I guess we all know this, the reason there's a 12 there is because when you take a derivative, it works, right? Do they tell the kids that? I don't know. Now it's enshrined into the great literature. Yeah.
But you've got more fitting parameters on this other one, right? So it's not so surprising.
It's not so surprising, of course. It's just pleasing. But what's really nice is that you can now make everything harmonious with what you know should have been the van der Waals interaction. Yeah, I mean, this is curve fitting, but it actually turned out to be a happy thing because it turns out you can take this huge amount of quantum stuff calculation and make succinct potentials. One of the things I keep wishing I'd find a statistical mechanician who would go back and look at a few noble gases with this potential and see it. Now, you know, computers can handle more than two coefficients or something nowadays. It'd be really nice to re-examine some of the data. Because there are still questions about face-centered versus body-centered packing, for example. And that clearly depends on range. And the papers I've seen that try to explain it, you know, if they come to fifth-order quantum corrections and stuff like that, it may be a much easier way into this problem. Oh, there's another really neat thing, that this is pairwise additive, right? The first-order interaction, if this isn't it's not your problem that you do have when you have charge fluctuations, that you have the problem of pairwise additivity. So then I thought I'd end with a couple of happy unifying stories here. So it's not a very nice term, your pseudo, but anyway, it's what you see these kinds of things going on. You've seen some of these, and a lot of our friends we've seen here, and I just thought I'd show these, that you can do perturbations in these cases and see how fluctuations change. Another one here, Phil Pankus, who's had an office this entire time, has achieved a degree of perfection today in that he's come to no lectures. I was really worrying that he was going to come to this lecture and I was going to have to say, Phil, you screwed up your perfect record. So anyway, but he did do this very nice calculations. And of course, we have friends here who are doing these things too. And I thought that's a very nice way to look at membrane inclusions as in a larger context. And it's been wonderful to be with you guys. And I don't mean just the good weather. It's been, you're a good bunch. So thank you. Nobody wants a free dinner card. Nobody.